Hello and welcome to a new episode of Foodocracy for Her. I'm Kalyan Karmakar, and this is a Diwali special episode, and it's a great, great pleasure and honor to invite a chef whom I've been observing for quite a few years and been experienced to work. And this is Chef Amrinder Sandhu, who's joining in today from Pune, but she also considers the suburb of Bandra, which I consider my home in Mumbai, to be her favorite home as well. So welcome on board, Amrinder.
And, thank you so
great
much.
To have you on. So, you know, Foodocracy for Her is a podcast where I speak to women in the food business. But the only reason for doing it is to bring the focus to women, because almost in every interview we've seen that what they've achieved is actually, gender neutral. It's like big inspiration. And in Amrinder's case, I'm actually going to read out. So, because it's a lot of things. So she was a national award winner in 2013-14 for the best lady chef, which was presented by the Ministry of Tourism. Then Marco Pierre White of Yes Marco fame called her the girl with gold in her fingers. So Sone, it's almost like an Indian thing. She represented India on Netflix in The Final Table, which was a global series. She won the Outstanding Entrepreneur in the culinary at the Guide Awards by Midday, featured in the 50 Best Discovery by the World's 50 Best Restaurants, Chef of the Year, so see Chef, not Lady Chef, at Condé Nast Traveler Top Restaurant Award 2019, guest judge on MasterChef India, featured on the cover of Condé Nast Traveler's very recent episode, issue 40 Chefs Under 40, and for a Diwali Dhamaka, she is now founder of Bliss Food Experiences, and we're going to talk about that, which is a wedding catering, but a very novel initiative, and Cooking Hats Hospitality, and where she's got launching some cloud kitchens with some very, very endearing names. So, Amrinder, I think, reading your bio itself would become the whole episode. but I'm so happy to this thing. In fact, if you remember, the first time we'd met was at the Taj Lands End.
And
with Chef Anindya Roy, and it was a fabulous dinner. And then he called the chef Anindya in, and he said that, look, it's all of what you ate is really her creation. So there are three phases to her career. When she came out of hospitality school at IHM, and then she worked with the Taj Group, then she became independent and worked in partnership with people, and then now she started her own. So I think each of these three is very, very interesting. So I'm going to start, Amrinder, first with your hotel experience. And, the traditional expectation or association with women chefs is that if they are at all in hotels and so on, it's typically in the cold kitchen or the pastry section or as a F&B manager, a bit sexist perhaps, but... you were actually in the hot kitchen. And I remember once telling people in a talk that you had to earn your right over there. So do you want to talk a bit about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you said my reading my bio is an episode in itself, because I've been professionally cooking for 20 years now. And so when I started out, there were very few female chefs. And there were more bad days than good, and every day was a struggle, but I loved it with all my passion, and I take immense pride in Indian cuisine, so I would show up to work every single day and learn a skill, because when I was growing up, my dad had once, he said this one thing to me which has stayed with me, and I think it will stay with me till I live. He said, you should learn a skill and you'll never die hungry. And so when I walked into, I remember my first day of training at Haveli in Taj Man Singh, and I saw this chef flying the Rumali, and I was blown out of my mind. I was like, oh my God, this is too cool, and I have to learn this. And for a week after that, I would wet a duster and try and learn how to rotate my hand and to, learn how to make a Rumali. And when I was able to do it, it gave me a great sense of accomplishment.
Yes.
And that's how most of the days of the training days were spent. And I remember I had gone to for a catering to the Prime Minister's house. And Dr. Manmohan Singh was the Prime Minister then. And it was me and a tandooria. And after the Prime Minister had eaten, the rest of the gang had to eat. And that's when the real rush came in, right? They wanted everything really fast. And this tandooria was slapping the bread into the tandoor, and he needed help. And I just jumped in. I was just a trainee. I didn't know. And somehow I think this cooking rotis in a tandoor is, I feel it's just ingrained. It was always there in me. Because that was my first day, and I just started helping him, and I was slapping rotis in a tandoor. And at one point he stepped back and he just watched me do it. And then he came back and he told my boss that she's good at the tandoor, you should put her in the tandoor section. And that was not usually that was done for a female chef. And I think that was the starting point. And my love for the tandoor just grew stronger every single day from there on.
You know, when you were telling me about this, I suddenly remember this evening in 1986-87 when I was in Calcutta and a teenager. Yeah. So, you know, just outside our house, there was a new roti dukan which had opened. So a small stall on the pavement where there were these guys who were selling roti, so tandoori rotis and rumali. And I remember going there as a 13-14-year-old, and I was transfixed. And like you said, it was all men over there. So there were these men over there, and there was on the road, they made a tango. And on that tap, 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 they're putting it in. And then hot stuff, they're taking it out. And the rumali is like magic. It's such a delicate, you know, thing. We talk so much about the delicacies in Japanese cooking and so on. But it's, and very recently I was at the, having dinner at the Peshawari. But again, you're right. It was all male. In fact, your influence is also very interesting because you're Punjabi. And if I got it right, you grew up in the Northeast?
Yes, I grew up in the Northeast.
Where about?
So in Jorhat, it's...
In Assam, right?
In Assam. It's 5 hours further Northeast from Guwahati, and lots of tea estates there. And but I grew up in a very Punjabi neighborhood. But I know my Naga pork just as well as I know my butter chicken. So I think it really helps me in my outlook towards Indian cuisine.
And yeah, because I saw you using recipe ingredients from Majuli, which is in Assam and so on.
Yes, so, because there are so many ingredients there which are not necessarily looked at as Indian ingredients.
Yeah, in fact, this is one thing which I'll be bringing up and highlighting a bit later in the interview. That, you know, right now it's very, I won't say easy, but it comes naturally to us when talking of the dining out scene in India to talk about Indian food, what Indian chefs are doing and so on. But the fact of the matter is that the groundwork for this was laid maybe at least 6-7 years back when it was still so much about international food. And you were one of the chefs who had been and has been consistently doing it. And I'm not sure if that has been appreciated enough, but the fact is that if we are here today in this stage where we are sort of awakening to the glory of our food, it's thanks to someone like you and your peers. So what were the challenges? I mean, why is it that women don't tend to sort of look for being in the hot kitchen, which is like the main dishes and all of that come out? Did you sort of face anything like that? Did you have to?
The reason for this is the kind of environment that is created in a hot kitchen. You know, it's not very conducive. It's not very friendly, and people are unnecessarily mean. And although there's a big change with more literate people becoming chefs and being conscious of their work environment, there has been a change, but we're still a long way off, you know. And our cities aren't very safe. You have to, if you want to work in a hot kitchen, you have to do a dinner service, which means you'll go home only post midnight. And then if you're a young chef who's just started out and you want to live by yourself, you should also be able to get home on your own, right?
Yes.
And that, most of our cities don't provide that. You know, Bombay, it's still possible. I remember I used to finish work, although at the Taj, we used to get a drop from 9:30 p.m. onwards, and this would really take care of us. And it's a great company to work with, and so much to learn from them in terms of ethics and just philosophy and giving back. And so we had a drop, but I would still stay longer than the drop and close the restaurant and leave at, say, 1:30, and I could just hop into an auto and go home. in Bandra, you know, from Lanza.
Yes, yes.
But that is not something that is possible in every city. And I think that discourages people, because even when I try and hire, and I make a conscious effort to hire female chefs in my kitchen, but I fail at it because either they don't have a very supportive family, or their passion for the craft is superficial, or the cities aren't, you know, they're not able to get home. Plus, it doesn't pay you well. So there is so many things that are working against you. That's the reason you see fewer female chefs. It has very little to do with your ability as a chef, because you're a female.
I remember once in a talk you were saying that, you know, people were saying that ye itna patli hai, dubli hai, vajan kam hai. So how will she lift the, you know, the
that's
big
what they make it. Yeah, they make it sound like a weightlifting competition. You know, it's
like
not
a locker room. Like
I mean, you should be physically fit, because it is very, very physically taxing, and lifting some weights before you decide to become a chef will definitely help. But it's not just about lifting weights, you know.
So do you have a sort of goal or vision that some point in your life you want to help change that? Because like you said, you're also consciously trying to hire more women chefs. So is there any sort of plan or something like in the future? Because of the stature you have and the exposure you have, would you like to slowly try to make a difference in this? Like maybe at some point?
I would definitely like to, and it wouldn't be just for female chefs. It would be for children of our country. And that's my ultimate goal, to be able to feed them well and create a home where they can live, and they're also get trained in some career and a professional training, and so that they're able to get jobs. That's what I imagine. That's my ultimate goal, and I hope I'm able to do that at some point.
I'm sure you will. Now, coming to Indian food, I remember like once I was chatting with Chef Ranveer Brar, who also worked in hotels and other chefs as well, that apparently a large part of the training which happens in the hospitality schools, like whether it's IHM or anything, tends to focus more on European cooking, Asian cooking, and not so much on the intricacies of Indian food, especially given that it's in India. Like you go to France to learn French cuisine. So he said that it's often, let's say when people join hotels or now restaurants and stuff like that, that's where the chefs are taught such things, and not everyone in the past wanted to sort of focus on Indian food. So how was it for you? Was it Indian food right from the beginning? Of course, you did say you did Rumali rotis on day one.
It was right from the beginning, because my grandmother, you know, whenever she wanted to show off, she would say, you know, I can cook rotis in a tandoor. And we would, and like as kids, like I used to feel like it's a very, very cool thing.
Your Ammu.
Yeah, my BG.
BG.
Yeah. Yeah.
So BG is mom's mom or dad's mom?
Dad's mom. She would like, whenever there was even a little chance to show off, she'd be like, "Main roti bana sakti hu tandoor pe," you know. So I think that also had a very big, you know, when you're so young, these things make a big impression. So, and I feel that, you know, I didn't want to, when it came to taking a specialization in which cuisine, I always knew that if I took up Italian, there always will be an Italian who would, you know, tell me this is not how it's done, you know, because I have no reference point in my childhood or growing up or any of my exposure till the time I don't pack my bags and go and live in Italy for 5-6 years. True. I cannot just take it up in another foreign country and then say that, you know, I know it all, because it has to come from a deep spot in your heart. You have to be... We are custodians of certain flavors, you know, there's nostalgia, there's all of that. And that's what allows you to create. I mean, if you're going to have a career which lasts for, say, 40 years and you have to constantly reinvent yourself, there has to be so much more to it than just taking up a foreign cuisine.
But that way of thinking was a bit rare, right? Back then makes you seem like you're a BG yourself, but you're not. But am I not right when I say that that sort of thinking now, because of like, you know, folks like people like you, or you know, so many people are saying that, oh, okay, we also want to learn our grandmother's recipe. But when you did that, it was still pretty novel, like, right? Because everyone wanted to do Italian, Thai, Japanese.
Absolutely.
But because... what you're saying is so commonsensical.
Common sense. Yeah, it is. So the thing is that, I think it has to, for me, it was later in my life that I discovered my true calling, right? I came to Bombay when I was 17. I studied science 3 years. I did BSc, 6 units of life sciences. And I remember that moment, like it happens in the movies. I was looking out of the lab. I was extracting DNA. The test tube was in my hand. And I decided, like lightning struck, and I discovered my true calling, and I said, I want to be a chef. And and that happened because I come from a family where food is really big. I mean, in Jorhat, Assam, you couldn't source any fancy ingredients, but whatever my mom couldn't source, she would grow it in her kitchen garden, but always up the game as far as food was concerned. You know, we went for picnics to dense forests, and my mama would teach us how to catch fish, and whatever we would catch, stuff it into a bamboo, throw it on open fire to cook it. So, I never thought growing up, I never thought that Indian eating what we eat at home is not cool or like it's not fancy. And if you cook this food, you will not be considered a chef. Because I think a lot with my other batchmates, what they felt is, this is what we eat at home. And if this is what I'm going to cook here, it doesn't mean like I've learned.
Yes.
Till the time you don't drop the fancy names and the techniques, it just doesn't feel like cool enough.
Yeah,
so I think that's what, but I was very clear. I knew that there was a lot to learn. And
was your family okay with it? Like your parents and all that? Because you were studying science. So did they envisage a different future for you to be like a scientist or whatever?
Yeah, my dad, from the day I was born, he was like, you will become a doctor. And I was very good in my studies. I topped my school in 12th standard.
Wow.
And he's like, doctor. Because my three siblings, all three are dyslexic, and they are very, very creative people, very skilled. But in school, they weren't doing well, right? So they were like the teachers. And back in those days, I mean, my sister's 9 years elder to me, like the teacher wouldn't think twice before calling you a duffer if you couldn't spell something, right? Yeah.
There was no Tare Zameen Par back then.
Hey, there was no Tare Zameen Par. There was no be sensitive to the kids, none of that. So that's what they had to deal with. And so they were like, oh, weird, we are losers, and she can spell, so she's the bright child. And so dad,
she's the only hope.
Yeah, so dad was dad's only hope, and he's like, to become a doctor. And even in his wildest dream did he ever think that I'll want to be a chef and I want to cook. Because I remember when I told my mom, she's like, this is what you have to do your entire life in Punjabi. She's like, sari umar rotiyan pakaniya. So, Jorhat, there were no 5-star hotels, you know.
Like, yeah.
So they didn't really know what being a chef was, other than what they saw on TV. Like, and those days, Yan Ken used to come and he would say, Yan Ken cook, so can you. And, you know, that was the only.
So many people on Foodocracy for Her, including my wife, who's not on Foodocracy for Her, because refer to Yan Ken cook.
Yeah. Yeah, right. It was just such a path breaking.
I know he should get a like Khel Ratna Bharat Ratna or something for launching so many chefs. And how was it in Taj when you said that you wanted to focus on Indian food? Was that accepted, or were they saying that no, do something else? And in which case did they train you did the chefs train you over there?
So we were given an option to let them know what our preference is and give two options, and I wrote Indian cuisine in both the options. And I just crossed my fingers and my toes and I hoped I would get it. And they did give it to me. And I think if they'd not given me that specialization, probably my life would have been very different. But because that happened, and then it was just one thing to the other.
So from Taj, you then moved out into being on your own. But what are the lessons which you carried with you and still carry with you in terms of the training which you had in such a big organization, such a big kitchen with so many experienced chefs and stuff like that? So what are the lessons or values that you took carried with you?
The biggest learning was to never say no to the guest, and the guest is always right, because you
really... Is the guest always right?
That, I mean, it sounds very cliched, but at the Taj, you live by that. I mean, every single day, you know. And even when you know that the guest is wrong, you still give them the benefit of doubt that, yes, you are right, and I will solve your problem, and I will fix this. And if there is a problem in the food, I will... service recovery is big. And I think that's been my greatest learning, because I've made a lot of friends who I went to talk to the table because there was a complaint. And just because of the way, you know, you handle a complaint, there's a big scope in acquiring a guest. And I think that has been my biggest learning at the Taj. It's the empathy you show at that point that makes such a big difference. And I learned a lot from Chef Roy. Like you even mentioned that when we met and you and Chef said, this is all her and this is
Yes, he did. He called you out specifically and it was a long dinner. And but, like I was keen to go home, but then we sat and chatted for quite some time and you're telling me about your experiences. Please, I would love to know a bit about, and I regard him very, very highly. He's now the general manager at Vivanta at Whitefield. But I would love to know like any influence he's had on your career or your way of thinking.
Very, very big influence for me. I mean, everyone dreaded Chef Roy. I mean, he was such a tough guy.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
He comes across as such a sweetie.
No. He's a tough taskmaster. He likes things perfectly. He has great understanding of food. And he taught me how to do simple things well. Whether I remember I made Sikh kebab 6 times for his approval. Like the 6th time he said, this is what it is. This is the right thing. And like simple things like butter chicken, dal makhani, all of that.
In fact, that was a meal where you guys had introduced this concept of a family mutton curry.
Yes.
And presented it in a pressure cooker at a time when no one was doing. Now people do pressure cooker, dabbas.
Now pressure cooker mutton curry is everywhere. It was It was my mom's recipe and with Chef Roy. I was like, you know, my dad, brother wouldn't even let my mom open the pressure cooker and transfer it to a bowl. She would just put it on the table and say, eat, you know, like, and we would like take off the whistle on the table and eat it. And he's like, we should recreate this whole memory. And that's how the Sunday, and we called it the Sunday mutton curry.
Yes.
In the Sardar household, Sunday lunch is mutton curry.
Same in Bengal. I mean, in the 80s and 90s, for some families, it moved to chicken. Yes. But and that curry was, it spoke so much of home and that whole experience of taking it out of a pressure cooker and all of that. I remember that's the night when after that we were talking and stuff. So you said that the biggest thing you got from him is to how even to focus on perfecting the simplest things, like not to take anything for granted.
No, and he would never take credit for someone else's work. He was just so cool, right? He's such a cool person that even when the managing director came to Land's End, and it just so happened it was a very busy night that night at the restaurant. So I cooked all of his food that was served. And Chef watched me because his office was right there and he could see from his window and he watched me cook it. And then the next day, the lunch was to him at to the MD at the Chambers, and he ate it and he's like, who's the chef? I want to meet this person who's cooked this food. And he's come down from the 26th floor and to my kitchen and says, come with me. And he takes me up and he's like, he steps aside and he's like, she cooked it. It's her food. It's her restaurant. She does it. And I think you have to be such a sorted, secure person to be able to do that.
It's not that common, right?
That's another big learning from him, to never take credit for someone else's work and what you should do for your team, you know, to nurture and allow them to grow. Because
and this sort of behavior is not common, right? I mean, it's not everyone who has that maturity.
And it's so rare. I mean, at the Taj, it was a very rare behavior. I have worked with other chefs who would say, hey, you know what, plate two plates, do the best plating. And then they would pose in front of the camera and say, this is our work, you know.
Just across professions, in fact.
Everywhere it happens, yeah.
But I think that these are the sort of leaders who sort of leave one's mark on one. I mean, I've had the good fortune of also working with some in my market research career like this. But I think these are the sort of people whom you sort of cherish and, you know. Okay, so now, you know, like it said that once you're an employee of, say, a Taj or an Oberoi or an ITC, you never leave. So, and you were at Land's End with one of the marquee hotels and got a fair bit of acclaim, quite sorted and secure. So why the move? Why? What was the desire?
Did
you do art? Tell me about it. Once bitten, twice shy. Twice not shy.
But I'm a Taj baby. I mean, I owe so much to the Taj.
It's not so much about the Taj. It's so you happen to be there. But why leave the security of a large, established organization and then move into a what was a startup at that point with people who didn't necessarily have a background in hospitality and so on. So would you like to tell us about?
So why I did it is because I believe if you're a chef, you should be an hands-on chef till the end of your career, and you should continue.
So you should be a?
Hands-on chef.
And hands-on chef.
Cook till the last day of your, till the last day you want to be a chef. And at a five-star hotel, once you rise up the ladder, then it becomes more administrative. You're just shooting meals to each other and taking your rounds. And that didn't seem very exciting for me. Being in a restaurant, being able to cook is what excites me a lot more than the administrative part of it. So that's
wow. This you know, resonates with people I think across professions, because those who are in a creative field, which cooking is, I mean, as you go up the ladder, you do get more into administrative things. So then it's a sort of you know, the call to whether sort of focus on your creative calling or get busy with Zoom calls and so on. But how were the experiences? I mean, moving out of such a sheltered atmosphere into, like, you know, not so sheltered. How was it?
I've thrown myself out of my comfort zone multiple times in my life. I have hit rock bottom twice in my life and been able to bounce out of it only because of my skill. And so, and I also know that if you, every time you throw yourself out of your comfort zone and do something very uncomfortable, you grow tremendously.
And I would like to know a bit about that, if you would like to share any of the two occasions where, or both, where you said that you hit rock bottom for whatever reason, and then you came out of it. But I think that will be very interesting for people. So anything, I mean, you'd like to share on that would be
lovely. So I'd hit a really bad phase in my life, personally, and I only had a job. And this was the second time I went back to the Taj to work. And we just changed the menu, not even a napkin, of a 13-year-old restaurant, and things just turned around. And
which one?
Masala Bay.
Masala Bay, yeah.
Yeah, and it's the thing with food is, and it has so much power, that you don't really have to go around telling people. If you just improve something and you consistently do it, somehow people just get to know, and you just start, you notice that that thing just starts selling. And that happened, and that's when I won the national award, and then it was just one thing to the other.
So imagine, from rock bottom to national award from the tourism ministry. Wow. Yeah.
It was, I didn't even know that it was such a prestigious award until I was walking up on the stage and my mom saw me on TV the first time then.
I think that also sums you up a lot, because I mean, your focus is always on the kitchen, in the kitchen, on the food. I mean, I mean, the share of glory has happened because of the work which you've done. But I don't think that... Is there any sort of philosophy or philosophical mooring which keeps you grounded? I remember, of course, what you said in the beginning about your dad's wise words, that learn a skill and you'll never grow hungry. Is there anything else? Because, you know, it's so much a mental game, right? I mean, to face adversities, challenges, and spring back in any adversity. So is there any spiritual grounding, or is there anyone you bounce off things from, or like a mentor or anything like that? I would love to hear that.
So I'm surrounded by people who keep me very grounded, and the slightest chance where I try and show off, they like bring me back like this.
In a good way, because they mean well.
Yeah,
because they mean well.
Yeah, it's my younger brother who's so, there is no gray in his... in his behavior, it's either black or white, and he's the one who's like, enough, you know, like, don't show up. And then also Brent, who's a dear friend, and he handles my, so he started off
Is it Brent Gomes?
Yes.
Oh, I have also known him from the early part of his career. Yeah. I mean, he used to handle the PR for Impresario, and I've met him once, a very, very few times.
He's a really sorted person, and so he's a wise soul. And so every time I try, like, even if I go to an event, so he started off with being handling my PR and communication. He still does that, but he's also we are working together and growing these brands together. And so every time I would go to an event and I would come back and say, hey, you know, and this person said this about me, and this one said that nice thing about me. He'll be like, oh, that's fine. Who else was there? What did they say about themselves? And, you know, like, like the world doesn't revolve around you, you know.
And I remember he was such a young boy when he started off, and you know, like how his very, very humble. And yeah. I mean, you never imagine, but it's lovely. So now let's talk about
two of the... Even my husband says that you have a, like every time I try to show up, he says, oh, is there a gland at the back of your head? It's the ego gland. Does it have to be inflated all the time? And
brave man.
Yeah. So I think these three people, they keep me very, and plus my mom also, I think she said that to me also very early on. And there is a line from Guru Granth Sahib which says, man niva mat uchi. So, you know, man as in you keep, stay grounded, keep your, like, don't be too flamboyant. And matuchi means, I don't know how to describe it too well. I think it basically means stay grounded. Simple living and high thinking is what it means.
Ah, okay. Simple living, high thinking. I'm going to remember this as well. In fact, even the Parsis have a similar saying, like good thoughts, good deeds, good action. Okay, now, like, let's go into some of the specific things which you did. Because you first moved to, you set up art in Bandra, and you know, there was this entire thing about your using natural chulas and, you know, the concept of smoke and stuff like that. And before that, when we think of smoke, it's all Western, like cured bacon, smoked steaks, is that. But to show, like I remember when I came to India, we lived abroad, my Thakuma, my dad's mom, cooking on a unon, which was with coal and stuff like that. But no one really thought of showcasing that till you did. So what was the thought behind that?
So at my last job at the Taj, before I started Art, I did a food promotion with the granddaughter of Maharaja Bhupender Singh of Patiala.
Yes, I remember going for that as well.
So she shared her family heirloom recipes with me, right? There were some recipes which were, and they were handwritten by her mother, and you know, and it had things like, if you can't find musk, you should use kevra. And when you encounter a line like that, you just know this recipe is so fresh. Yeah. And she would talk me through it. And at the end of it, always say, you know, but if this was cooked in a heavy bottom copper lagan on open fire, this is going to taste absolutely different. And then something just clicked inside. I mean, she just reinforced what I already believed in. And
yes,
I decided that when I do my next restaurant, I'll not use any gas and I'll cook on open fire and I'll try and revive some of the techniques that we've forgotten.
And which is tough to do in a 5-star, right? Because safety regulations and all of that.
Yeah, so this was Art. So
No, that's what I meant. That like you might have got the idea when you were in Taj, but it might be difficult to implement if you'd stayed on there. That's what I meant.
Yes, that would have been like, let's do a new restaurant, let's get the partner sanctioned, maybe 5 years.
Yeah.
So that's how Art happened, and I custom designed all my equipment. I mean, I'd just seen a small angiki in my mom's backyard, and I blew it up to an industrial size to be able to handle a busy dinner. And
that's where the scientist in you came to use.
Yeah, then a sand pit to cook meats under hot sand overnight.
Wow.
Lots of things cooked in bamboo, wrapped in leaves. And because I think, and this whole slow cooking, because an angiki allows, when you cook in heavy bottom copper lagans, it allows you to slow cook your food. And slow cooking really makes a lot of sense with the kind of food we eat, because most of our gravies, our meats are braised. So when you slow cook them, it takes it to a different dimension.
I have a slow cooking story, which as a chef, there's a saying, I don't know if you come across it, but I'm sure even about a langar, but you know, the Durga Puja or Saraswati Puja, the Bengali, this thing, bhoger khichuri, the khichuri which is served in the bhog. And you know, people say that you can never match it at home. And of course, one links it to the fact that bhoger khichuri is off to the goddess, blessed by the goddess and all of that. But for a moment, if one takes a slightly rational touch to it, so I once went to the Bandra Puja. I go there and there's a chef called Govindoda on Odia. So he makes the khichuri and stuff. So then he was telling me that, he makes the khichuri by 8 o'clock. And then big digs. So not copper, of course, but, you know, the big digs. And then, he finishes the cooking. And then the food is served from 1 o'clock onwards. So, and we volunteers eat at 2:33.
Yeah.
So from 1 to 2, sorry, from you know, 8 to 1 o'clock, cooking's done, it's kept there, but in that heat it just keeps cooking, right? And so the way he leaves it at 8 o'clock and in the morning, and what we get at 1 onwards is very different. It's still piping hot, so we have to be very careful. So I feel that a bit of the magic comes from there. And absolutely. And you must have so many experiences like that. Huh? What do you think?
The way ingredients break down when they're slow cooked is very, very different from when you do a rushed job. Mm. And cooking is all about patience.
Mm. You have like for example, Kesar Dhaba in Amritsar, which claims that their chulas never shut down.
It's cooked in desi ghee and it's slow cooked, and it's just like you feel it in the food when you eat it. It's just simple things, but it's beautiful.
You also took a big step over there on, like, you know, going very, very Indian at art, and I think it was still very Indian, was not trendy, you know, as it was. So how was the reaction? Because, you know, there are two schools of thought. Once I think Riaz Amlani told me that, you know, Bombay is the toughest market and they're always being an experiment there last. But another school of thought is that Bombay probably has the most experimentative audience, or willing to try, but if it goes wrong, then maybe not come back. So what was your experience?
So I so strongly believed in it that, and with us Indians, I think we like to eat different cuisines for a few days, and then we want to eat our own desi.
Oh, yes, yes.
And then you want that one restaurant where you know that,
yes,
you know, it hits the right spot. So that's what I was banking on, and it worked.
Awesome. So your next move, largely, I think that is then sort of was the natural funnel to what you're doing now. And so before that, so your next move from art was then, I think, Ikhtara,
yes,
which was launched just before the pandemic, right?
3 weeks before the pandemic.
But it was meant to be a cloud, a delivery thing right from the beginning. So in a sense, like, you know, the delivery model, which sort of rose in the pandemic, you just happened to sort of, you know, go a bit ahead of that. So, but for you, who's always sort of been in a 5-star luxury atmosphere, and that too with the Taj, then again, art, which was again reasonably upscale and an upscale Bandra and things, to suddenly seeing your food going in dabbas or matkas and all of that, and being opened in, you know, a house which you have under no control. For a lot of chefs, it was a lot of unlearning and then learning which had to happen. You know, which is very different from home chefs. Home chefs also had their own method of learning because they never cooked commercially. But for folks like you, there's a lot of unlearning. So tell us a bit about that. Because, I mean, why would a chef want to get into the dabba mode?
So I would say...
And you did this before people had to do it. I mean, then later people realized that they had to do it to survive. But you did it before that. You actually chose it.
Yes, I actually chose it. So the thing is that I think with my, even like I found my rhythm in cooking is when I realized that cooking has got to do a lot with being intuitive. And I think women in general are more intuitive, and somehow you get to know, like I feel sometimes I get to know things before they happen. Like I can, like at that point, it just felt like it was the right thing to do. Because the only thing that was done with delivery kitchens was the price point, you know. You could get cheap food, but there was nothing that it's going to be great quality. It will be reasonably priced, but it's a takeout. And there were other circumstances which aided that whole thought, but it just happened 3 weeks before the pandemic, because I was going to open 2 restaurants. But then they were derailed because of the pandemic. And delivery kitchen then just made sense.
So what did you take out of that experience? Because like you said, for example, in the Taj experience, 2 things you took out was that the customer is right, and 2, give credit where it's due, which is thanks to Chef Anindo. What did you take out of that, moving to a delivery where suddenly people can't see you? Because I remember you were saying a bit earlier that in Taj, some of your strongest friendships were created when you went to a customer's table where maybe there were some issues and got to know them. And suddenly you became faceless. So how was that?
So then that's what we feel.
At a personal level. Yes. At a personal level, how was it for you?
Yeah. So so I think it's about how you train your brain. That is one thought process that you can take. And the other is that you are a chef. You left the Taj because you wanted to cook. And here you are cooking in a kitchen, which is called a dark kitchen. I hate that word. I don't know why it's called a dark kitchen. There's enough light in there. it's the love for your craft. You want to cook. So you cook and you, whether it's at a wedding catering or at a restaurant or something that's going to go in a dabba, it's about cooking. And that is what should be taken seriously, nothing else. That's what I feel.
Wow, that's really profound, because the fact is that what you said is that you're in it because you want to cook. So now I'm just thinking that people who are in any other profession, like whether one's an engineer or writes in advertising, food writing, is a doctor, whatever, because the truth is after 17, 18 months of the pandemic, the world is changing. And for a lot of people, there's a lot of relearning and a lot of eating the humble pie, perhaps.
Yes.
But having that core focus, like which for you is the love to cook and feed, and also, like I said, to explore Indian food. If you keep your eyes on that goal, I think that's one of the great takeaways I'm going to take out of this.
Yeah,
and then
your circumstances are constantly going to change in life,
and it's not in your control.
It's not in my it's in nobody's control. But you have to stay focused. The focus is to cook delicious food. So just do it whether it's in, it could be anywhere. It could be a langar I'm cooking in a gurdwara.
I want to ask you this again, that how did you come to this realization? Was it your own, experience over the year, or was it someone who spoke to you, or is it like a religious philosophy or a philosopher or whatever? The reason why I'm saying it is that, because I practice the Buddhist philosophy, and some of these things one has tried to learn from there. Of course, it's a different question whether you can then implement what you're learning, internalize it. So I'd love to know a bit about that. Or is it like, is it you who over the years who sort of realizes?
I think it organically happened to me, and I don't even know that I know now that you're asking me that, is it, is there some bit of wisdom in there? But the thing is, I think it's just been an organic growth. And I love what I do. I have genuine love for being able to cook a meal and touch someone's heart.
Wow.
I enjoy doing that. And I've never even thought of doing anything else,
So, next time if anyone ever asks me a question about something on this line of thought, I'm definitely going to quote you and say that one of the people whom I realized this was when I spoke to you. Okay, now we've got about 15 minutes left and you're doing so much. So tell us a bit about your journey after that, where for the first time in life, you became a solo operator because you've been in service.
Yes.
Then you worked in partnership with people. But for the first time, it was completely on you. Blissful Foods, and then Ammu's Kitchen, and then Barfi and Sons. I just love that name. So tell us a bit about what's happening in your life now.
So from my experience of running a cloud kitchen for a year and a half, I realized that you must do multiple brands from the same facility for the cost to be able to make sense, cover a larger radius, and you should also have some brand visibility. So I call my vision, which I'm in the process of achieving, a jigsaw puzzle, where just a piece in isolation doesn't work. When it'll all come together, and it might take me a year and a half to put it all together, that's when I'll see the real results. So I'm okay to have patience for that much time.
But do you have the end picture in mind?
I have the end picture. The end picture is always, I always have great clarity with that. Like after Earth also I have an unfulfilled wish in my heart. After Iktara I had an unfulfilled wish in my heart. So right now I am working on fulfilling that dream. And then even with Earth I have a plan to fulfill that. So I'm not in a rush to do a restaurant because I want to build on that philosophy of cooking on open fire, but I want to do it when the time is right and when I feel I'm in the right environment with the right
So what are you doing on the Blissful Kitchen? Because there's wedding catering and people have, you know, most of us have this one image of wedding catering where there's a Pani Puri chart and you know, there's Luchi or Shawangzi, depending on which part of the country you're in, or like, you know, mutton pulao dal and stuff. But what are you doing? And that's in the pandemic time where it's so difficult. I mean, you can't just go to a buffet table and pick up stuff.
No, so I call it Bliss Food Experiences, and it is a very chef-driven wedding catering company. So the last wedding I did, I collaborated with 9 top chefs of the country.
Wow!
And
but you drove it. You drove it.
Yes, I curated the whole thing. I mean, they did their menus. We put it all together. Made sure that it worked.
And how did that work? Because 9 chefs and plus you, so which is 10 creative minds. And you know, giving each one their space and everyone's own well-earned egos, perhaps. how is it?
We had a ball. We had the best time. Those 4 days that we worked together, it was just. I mean, there's just brotherhood and being chefs, right?
Would you like to tell us who some of the people you worked with?
Yeah, so there was Prateek from Mask. There was Rashim from Impresario. There was Manuel from La Loca. There was Sifa. There was Karan. And there was Vinesh who did the desserts. And we just had a great time. I think we didn't have any ego hassle. I just felt very, very strong. It was like I had my brothers with me and we were going to totally kill this.
Maybe a bit of the chef Anirudh, the influence came of use here, perhaps, of leading a team. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, unknowing.
But that's fabulous because, you know, in a wedding, you know, sometimes, okay, I must say that, you know, in every community, there are certain caterers. You know, in a Parsi thing, if you know, it's a Godiwala catering, or in Bengal, when I was growing up in Calcutta, if it was Bhor, you know, in the 80s and so on. But the concept of a wedding catering done by chefs seems a bit hard to...
So that's what, I mean, I wanted to make a difference there, and it's a very, very challenging job because there is no scope to recover a situation. And if you mess up, you're even before your company can be launched, it will be ground. So,
and it's such an important landmark in your client's life, you know.
Yeah, and these are high budget weddings, so there's really no scope for error, and people are at their demanding best during a wedding.
And anyway, tempers are short, and not because of the food, but like we saw in monsoon wedding, Mirana's.
Exactly. So it was 3 ceremonies. The first day we did everything in small plates and everything was plated. The second day we did open fire cooking. So it was me on one end and Prateek on the other end, where I did my traditional, he did his very new agey beautiful food. The third day was a sit down for 120 people, brigade style service, all 120 served at the same time. There were 60 servers. Each course was choreographed. There was mapping on the table. It was... Yeah, it was like we just transported them to a different world.
Wow.
And it was
so, you know, people talk of destination weddings. So through the food you took them to, created a whole new destination.
So we did easy 2-3 Michelin star standard quality meal. Wow. That's 5 courses with 4 other chefs. And, you know, you had to pick up the 120 plates in 5 minutes.
Wow.
So that whole...
And I've seen Indians generally struggle in banquets, when I've gone abroad, the way banquets are handled, large numbers, I've seen, like, even in our hotels and all that, people struggle. Like, sometimes the food comes in cold, this thing. But to bring in that level of service is just amazing. Okay, so now, before I get lost in that amazing world, which you're in, I'm now thinking how to sort of gate crash into a wedding like that when it happens next. But tell us a bit about... what's happening in Ammu's kitchen and what is Mr. Barfi and his sons up to?
So Ammu and Barfi and Sons are the 2 out of the 5 brands that I'm going to launch.
Who came up with the names?
So it was Brent and me.
Lovely, lovely, lovely.
Yeah, so all the names were us. And so at Ammu, it's, so my friends call me Ammu. And it's pretty much an extension of my character. So it has everything. It has a lot of things that you would probably not expect on the menu. Like there is a chicken dish. I call it my South Indian chicken because I can't really put it in a particular region and I serve it with that dosa. But it's something I made at home and my family really loved it. And they would keep requesting me, can you make that South Indian chicken? So I call it my South Indian chicken. With set dosas. There's of course Deomali, which is mutton cooked in a bamboo and rice wrapped in a tikka leaf. Then there is of course butter chicken, dal makhni or butter naan. Then there's a very legendary recipe, which is from my, so it, my dad's friend owned a hotel there and it was their recipe and I ended up having it. So I'm the only person outside the family who has it. I call it the Sandhu Saab. So we do a biryani, we do a roll and we do, even as just as a gravy, as just as a main dish. So these are just some of the things on Ammu. And you know, and even the name Sandhu Saab, I call Chef Ranveer Baral for advice whenever I need, and he gives me advice like an elder brother would. No matter how busy he is, he would answer my call and he will.
How lovely.
And then at the end of it, he would say, always say, Baki ta di marzi ya Sandhu Saab, like rest is up to you, you know, to decide what you want to do. So when I was thinking of a name for this recipe, which has so much story to it, we just decided, let's just call it Sandhu Saab.
For people of my generation, I mean, you're the second Sandhu Saab after Balwinder Sandhu, who helped us win the 83 World Cup. I was still a bit too young to stay up for that one, but from 84 onwards, you know, onwards. So both Barfi and
even Bhagat Singh's surname was Sandhu.
That too we didn't know. So third, great lineage. and both of these are available in Mumbai and Pune.
Both in Mumbai and Pune, we are on Swiggy, Zomato, on Thrive, also direct numbers on my Instagram page.
beautiful, but that's so amazing to know, and I'm eagerly waiting. To see each piece of the jigsaw to fall into place, and then so, when it does, chat again.
I was just going to say two lines about Barfi and Sons. I forgot to mention.
Yes, please do.
So my thing with Barfi and Sons is it's just honest mithai. There is no milavat, because even if you think of the biggest brands, the very popular mithai brands, there is a lot of milavat that goes on. So we use no color. We don't mix any dalda and ghee. It's ghee, it's Kashmiri saffron, it's great quality ingredients, and it's just cooked with, made with a lot of care. And it's your predictable mithai. It's your motichur laddu. It's that there's a laddu.
So you're not making a motichur fondue or a motichur macaron or something.
That's just not my vibe. I mean, it just doesn't work for me, you know. Unless you have an idea which is so mind-boggling that it's better than the motichur laddu, I mean, why do it?
Yes. And have you ever tried the Dorbesh of Calcutta, as in tried eating it or something?
Yes.
I love both. You know, I love the Motichur laddu, which is soft, squishy, and the Dorbesh. Yes. It's
beautiful.
It's such a beautiful, chunky.
And it has a little coconut in it.
And then a little cashew or a kishmish.
Black cardamom seeds in it. So the coconut and the black cardamom seed is what does it for me in that laddu.
Yeah, in Bengal, we can't really afford saffron and all that when you're growing up. Yeah. So that little bit of kishmish or the kaju would take you straight to, you know. And what's the next one on anvil? Are you ready to talk about that after Barfi and Sons and this thing?
So there's a Chole Kulche brand, there is the chaat brand, and then there's the Mexican brand. So with the Mexican brand, I just want to do tacos the way they're meant to be done. You know, make your own masa, make your own tortillas, which melts in your mouth, doesn't taste like cardboard. Your meats are slow cooked, they're smoked. And you have like a really messy dripping. There's no polite way to eat a taco, right?
Yes.
So I think, I imagine my taco stands all over Bombay.
It'll be so, wonderful. I mean, they say that it's only when you dream that dreams come true. So may all your imaginations come true. And for guys who are dreaming of having great comfort food and great food in Mumbai and Pune, Ammu's waiting, Mr. Barfi's waiting, and keep watching Chef Amrinder's Instagram page. There are lots and lots of news there. Some some like the wedding stuff and all that, you know, when one sees stuff in the background, like I remember when Sifa traveling, the Pratek, seeing a bit of that, but we don't always get to know that till we have a talk, but it's just fabulous. And like I said, even in the beginning, that while Foodocracy for Her focuses only on women, but I always say that the interview is because of one's professional achievements. And Chef, you've shown exactly how, I mean, it doesn't, none of what you've done is women-centric or anything like that. It's because of your vision, expertise, and accomplishments. And we are very proud to sort of, I mean, what am I saying? Even I'm like, I consider myself a Bandarite, though I've been here for this 20 years. But we all just are happy and proud to have you as a Bandra girl over here. So you should be Amrinder Sandra Sandhu.
Yeah. That's a nice one. I'm going to use it.
Yes, please do. Please do. So here's wishing you and Brent from your team, your husband, your family, your friends, well-wishers and your own team a very, very happy Diwali, also Gujarati New Year over here, and a great 11-12. Okay. See you. Bye.
Bye-bye. Take care. Thank you so much.
Bye. Thank you.